'Tis the season for some cursing. This has been your obscenity warning.
This is Unorthodox. We are the number one Jewish podcast that you're listening to right now. And I'm your host, Mark Oppenheimer, joined by Tablet Deputy Editor Stephanie Butnick.
Merry Christmas.
Ho, ho, ho. And this week, sitting in the Leibovitz Memorial Chair, producer Joshua Cross. How are you, Josh?
Ho, ho, ho.
Ah, there we go. Ho, ho, ho. Liel is in the Holy Land where he is doing a meetup. There's still time to get in on that meetup, right? I don't think the meetup has happened yet, the Tel Aviv meetup.
I do not think so.
So if people, we have like 30 people who've RSVP'd already. All of Tel Aviv wants to see Liel. If you want to see Liel in Tel Aviv, he's going to have a bar night out. Location to be disclosed to you when you write to us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com and just put hanging with Liel in the subject line and then you will hang with Liel. Have you guys been checking the mailbox about how many people want to hang with Liel?
No, I've been seeing on Facebook and everyone's like, you're amazing. I can't wait to hang out. And I was like, wow,
yeah.
Coming out of the woodwork for Liel over here.
Yeah. I mean, I had a great hang when I was there 2 Marches ago, but this hang, first of all, we have a lot more listeners now than then. And also it's like, it's Liel. I think people want to do Eretz Yisrael.
Yeah. The way God intended.
That's right, with Liel. Fa la 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 la, in honor of Jews' favorite holiday, Christmas. Our guests this week are Christmas-themed, though they're Jews. Bill Adler, the Jewish hip-hop executive whose annual Christmas playlists have developed a cult following, is going to be here to talk to us about how to do a Christmas playlist right, because he's been doing it right for how many years? When did he?
32, 33, I think.
Yeah, he's terrific. And then Steven D'Souza, who wrote the screenplay for the greatest Christmas movie of all time, Die Hard, is going to be here to talk to us about Christmas movies, in particular, his own. But before we get to them, Stephanie Puttick, in this Christmas season, what's up?
I love Christmas. I think I have a very positive relationship with Christmas because I grew up in a pretty Jewish area. So I didn't really see much Christmas until I went to college. And I was like, what is this thing? I love it. So it's not like I was the only Jewish kid in a town filled with Christmas trees, which I understand why people have a more complicated relationship. I'm very pro Christmas and I'm a real fan. I don't have Christmas envy. I just have Christmas curiosity.
You have no Christmas envy, no Christmas guilt, no Christmas angst.
I'm so excited to be in New York. Usually I'm away this week. Tablet's offices are closed for the Christmas week typically. So we work remotely. And so Ben has been covering college football bowl games. So usually I'll go with him for New Year's and we'll sort of make a trip out of it. But I'm going to be here in New York all week. And I just want to have a very Jewish Christmas, Chinese food every day, movies every night.
Window displays
the whole week.
During the day.
Yeah, I want to love it.
That sounds amazing. Growing up in Great Neck, though, were there the Jews who did, were there Christmas trees? And I was like, will those Jews do Christmas?
I think if you were had a one Christian parent, you probably did. I saw Christmas trees. It was never all my friends had Christmas trees and I didn't and I felt left out. There was none of that. It was more a curiosity from afar.
Josh, what was Christmas in New Jersey for you?
Well, my mom grew up elsewhere on Long Island in Merrick and there were Christians there that she sort of could tell stories about doing the caroling thing. And it was always a thing that other people were doing and was fun to do.
I didn't realize caroling was real. I just thought it was in movies.
Oh, it totally is. I've got stories.
They just come to your house and sing?
It's creepy as hell.
I've been meaning to tell that story as well. So yes, it's not a story. It's just we used to have carolers come by and it was wonderful. There'd be 8 or 10 of them. You'd open the door and there'd be beautiful Christians holding candles. And they'd sing God Rest You Merry Gentlemen to you.
That creeps me out a little. Oh, really? That's overt religion. A Christmas tree, I'm whatever.
Oh, no. I wish, God, would somebody send carolers again? I thought it was,
I don't know. It's kind of creepy.
Oh, I loved it.
I don't like people showing up anywhere in my house.
Yeah.
You don't like people knocking on your door.
No.
You're Sid. Because, if you grew up in an apartment building in New York, nobody knocks on your door.
There's a problem.
There's no Halloween.
People knock
no Jehovah's
on doors
Witnesses.
In Springfield,
Massachusetts. We do Halloween. Yeah. Our building,
the
floors get decked out. Yeah, but yeah. Christmas, not so much.
So what's up with you up in Harlem, Josh?
Well, getting ready for today, I do my normal Tuesday morning tradition, which is I am fortunate enough that we record on the day that new episodes of Savage Lovecast drop. So I was listening on my way here to Dan Savage, who's going to be with us in Seattle. And I am super excited. I've been reading and listening to him for forever.
You learned how to make love from Dan Savage, basically.
Savagely.
Savagely.
Don't tell my wife.
Okay. That's right. You hide the book under the mattress.
Yes. A 50-something-year-old gay man taught me.
Yeah.
Anyway. So he was talking about the season and how there are different ways to celebrate. And I think it was interesting because it bounced off of something that's been going on in the Facebook group, is there's a lot of people who are put off by copious Christianity and copious Christmas that they feel left out. And it's interesting because it's a different group of people than I think normally participate. So there is certainly a subset of our audience that is sort of taken aback by this Christmas pageant doesn't have a single song, whereas, you know, here I'm used to my kids' school having the Ladino Hanukkah song, the other Ocho Candelicas, and like 55 other things, and the Kwanzaa song and everything else. And so it's been interesting to see that perspective, and sort of Dan made me think of it again this morning.
Yeah.
Well, there was the thing about the woman whose daughter got sent home, or she wasn't allowed to wear Hanukkah socks. It was Christmas sock day. And there's like, and you
that's
realize
what
like,
I'm missing by not being like, that's really intense.
There's a lot that happens in places where majority of people are Christian, and it's like accepted that that's what you do. And so I do think that I'm like, I'm glib about like, I like Christmas, because to me that just means like a Rockefeller Center tree that I'm never actually going to see, and like songs on the radio. But like, if you live in a place where it can feel oppressive, I think, and you could feel in the minority.
The flip side is the largest drama we ever had at the Christmas concert at my kid's school on the Upper West Side is there was a evangelical transplant from Nebraska. And she was like, what are all these non-Christian songs going on at the Christmas concert? We were like, you're in the wrong city.
Right. You knew where you were moving.
You knew where you moved.
So Rebecca actually had in social studies this week at her public school in New Haven, she had there was like World Religions Day, or it was Jewish Day. I think they'd been doing World Religions Week and they had Jewish Day. And Rebecca, of course, is like, you know, her bat mitzvah is soon. She's in like peak Jewish form.
Yeah.
And I was like, Rebecca, this is going to be tough. Like, they're not going to get this right. She's like, I know, Dad. It's I'll survive this day. So at the end of the day, I said, what did they have in school? And she said, well, you know, there was some readings from our World Religions book that said that there's liberal Judaism, conservative Judaism, and Orthodox Judaism, and liberal and conservative Jews are the ones who don't follow dietary rules, and Orthodox do. Which, of course, is like wrong on
that's
the face
kind
of it.
That's kind of an amazing and like blurring of
also like
reality.
Yeah, it's like it's wrong. It's also like weirdly reductionist in the wrong way. And then she said, at the end of the day, there was there was a quiz question, a multiple choice that was like, which of the four is not a branch of Judaism? Liberal, Orthodox, conservative, conformist.
I want to be a conformist Jew. By like, the way, actually, liberal Judaism, that's such a misnomer. And then, because then it makes conservative Judaism, like, you would think different things of those words.
Except in England, call reform. So it's they call it liberal Judaism. It was a hot mess. Have you been cooking with Jay Chef, Josh?
I have. You know,
speaking of hot messes.
But well, tasty
in
hot
fact,
messes.
In fact, it was a mess only because for people who don't know, I have three kids, and Mark probably appreciates this. Do you ever make a meal that all of your kids eat?
Sid knows how. It definitely happens when Sid's cooking. It seldom happens when I'm cooking. It's always a challenge.
I mean, in our house, we're cookers, so I don't necessarily need the meal plan stuff done for me. But I will say that we got this box, and I was like, all right, kids, you're going to help me. And we sat down and did it. It was the same one Stephanie got, the salmon maple. What was it? I forget again.
It was a maple crusted, maple glazed salmon.
Exactly.
It was really good.
No, it was really good. And what was amazing is like that was the one night that week that all three of my children ate without complaining, because they are a pain in my ass every night unless I cook three things or tell them to be quiet.
J Chef, it will shut up your kids.
Yes, that's their new slogan.
So people should go to jchef.com and enter the code unorthodox30.
Right, and they'll get 30% off their first
30%
order.
30% off.
And the recipes that Gabriel has put together, they seem to, you know.
They unite
they're
families.
They're great. They unite my very obnoxious children, which is a mitzvah in and of itself.
They bring shalom bite. They bring peace in the home.
They bring shalom bite.
We're coming out. Gabriel, listen, we have a couple slogans for you.
We are here.
We are writing your copy for you. I do just want to say two more things about what's going on at the Oppenheimer home front. The first is that Mondays are now Cheeto Monday, because we had Cheetos a few weeks ago and Rebecca really loves Cheetos. She's like, Dad, why don't we have Cheetos more often? And the reason is, of course, because we are, you know, culturally snooty Northeasterners, you feel like, well, you can't feed your kids orange food, right? But then I was like, why not? We have ice cream every night, right? Like, they watch a ton of TV. Why not Cheetos? So we've instituted Cheeto Monday. And that involves a baggie of Cheetos in her lunch. And then when she comes home, her after-school snack is Cheetos. I'm just putting that out there because I want people to know what's going on in the Oppenheimer household. The other thing is that I don't know if I've told the J. Crew that I'm doing this book about Pittsburgh. I don't know that I've mentioned that I've been flying to Pittsburgh every week to do a book on the aftermath of the shootings at the Tree of Life Synagogue. And what I really hope to do is not write a book about the shootings, but about Squirrel Hill, about the community and how it thrives and survives in the aftermath of tragedy. So that's been really, really meaningful. It has, however, turned me into a Steelers fan, which has put some stress between me and Rebecca because she's in hardcore Patriots mode. Speaking of sports, speaking of grown men with balls, the Patriots star Julian Edelman, whose father, of course, is Jewish and has written a Jewish children's book for the PJ Library, or has had ghostwritten for him a Jewish children's book for PJ Library, wore cleats that said Eitz Chaim, like Tree of Life, written in Hebrew. And he tweeted out the names of the 11 victims of the shooting. So go him.
They're great cleats. One of them says Eitz Chaim, which means Tree of Life, which is the synagogue in Pittsburgh. And the other one has a big Jewish star on it and says hashtag stronger than hate.
Some of you will remember the story where Bimbo Bakeries, which does mass amounts of baking for many different brands, was losing its blanket kashrut certification. So the Jewosphere was very worried that a lot of brands, including Entenmann's and Stroman's and Arnold's Rye Bread, Levy's Rye Bread, wouldn't be kosher anymore, which of course would be a disaster of huge magnitude. But it turns out some of the products are going to keep their kosher certification. I'm not sure how, like if there'll be a rabbi patrolling that corner of the Bimbo Bakery. But apparently Arnold's Rye, Levy's Rye, Entenmann's, Thomas's, is that Thomas's English Muffins?
Yeah.
Thomas's was going to lose the little, wow.
We need our kosher English muffins.
We need our kosher English muffins.
We're not Jews without them.
Can I just say that the best thing actually about Bimbo Bakeries is that it's a Mexican company and they sponsor the Guadalajara soccer football team. Mm-hmm. And Chivas Guadalajara is this beautiful white jersey with Bimbo written across the front.
It's Bimbo. It's not like what we are saying it as.
It's Bimbo, yeah.
Bimbo.
But it's still, you can buy a soccer jersey that just says Bimbo front.
That's awesome. And so people can return to eating the Bimbo products or some
of
them.
Eat those Entenmann's donuts. We're back. People were very upset about that.
Big thanks to Josh Cross, our producer. He will be back at the end of the show for our Mazel Tovs and our letters. But for our first guest this week, we go back to a time when Liel Leibowitz was still in New York, and he sat in with us here at Argo Studios as we interviewed Bill Adler. Have a listen.
Our Jewish guest this week is Bill Adler. He is a hip-hop expert. He worked at Def Jam in the 80s. He wrote the authorized biography of Run DMC, but he is also a Christmas music fanatic. Each year, he puts out a very cool holiday playlist, and he's been kind enough to share this year's with us. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you.
And happy Hanukkah.
We're way past Hanukkah at this point.
What?
And we're over it.
We're over it.
So early this year.
So, Bill, what makes a nice Jewish guy like you, when did you just become obsessed with Christmas? Or is it just music specifically?
Well, yeah, I'm a music lover. And what happened is I married a Gentile woman. And for the first time in my life, I celebrated Christmas. And I found a lot to like about the holiday, except for the soundtrack. And so I started to create my own.
You mean tuning into like Light 100 and hearing the, you know, endless replay of Brenda Lee's Rockin' Around the Christmas, like you wanted to go beyond that?
Always.
When you say the soundtrack, what was the soundtrack you were getting?
The same thing everybody gets. You know, I mean, I happen to be, just when this airs, I will have turned 67.
And, Mazel tov.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And, so I started listening to, you know, Christmas music like everybody else. I was listening all the time. I'm inundated by it, you know, at Christmas, starting in the 60s. And even, first of all, the universe of it is kind of lame, as it is for almost any idiom. You know, the best stuff is great, and most stuff is mediocre, okay? And it's certainly true of Christmas. But having said that, you know, there's a core of traditional Christmas recordings and Christmas compositions that are wonderful. And even so, those get beaten the fuck into the dirt through repetition.
Right. You don't want to hear them again, ever.
At all ruined. Listen, I grew up in Detroit in the 60s when Motown was at its height, and I can't listen to the top 100 Motown songs now. So it's not just a Christmas thing.
All right, so tell us the history of your playlist. Like, it started off, it was a mixtape you made for a few friends. When did you start it? Why? Who got the first, those first early mixtapes?
Well, let me just be clear. As I said, I make it for myself to begin with. And, you know, it turns out that first family and then some friends heard about it. And you know, I started to make as many copies as I needed to satisfy requests, basically. And I've done it consecutively every year since 1984. And it grows. And what I think it speaks to, you know, I'll take some credit for the specificity of my taste. But also, I think that, you know, more generally, lots of people are looking for an alternative to the typical Christmas music.
So here's my question. I've been listening to these playlists nonstop, literally, for the last 4 days. They
getting in the Christmas spirit.
Fucking amazing. Oh, they're amazing, 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 amazing things. I hear completely what you're saying about how every playlist, every kind of like idiom has its own limited set. But it seems to me Christmas is way more constrained than others. There really are.
I'll tell you why.
20 or 30 songs. And here is this whole universe that you've discovered. Why can't we hear some of that on the radio?
Because Christmas is an emotional time for folks who celebrate Christmas unironically. And those folks treasure tradition. And so it's like, you know, eating a fruitcake or something. I think pretty generally, fruitcake is kind of reviled. But at Christmas time, if it's served to you, you're going to love it because, you know, your mom served it to you at Christmas, you know, when you were a kid.
It's the gefilte fish of,
although,
of Christmas.
I'll tell you what, I prefer gefilte fish to fruitcake.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do too.
Maybe you could do both together, maybe see what happens.
Let me try a crazy idea.
That's avant-garde.
I know that in the early days especially, you've talked about how a lot of these were tunes that you found just, you know, diving into the bins at shops that sold vinyl. There are fewer shops that sell vinyl, and sometimes it feels like there's everything on Apple Music or Spotify.
That's not true.
But it's not true, right? I mean, right. You still, what's the mix of where the different places you find the new stuff now?
Well, you know, I search all year round, and I search, you know, fairly everywhere. And as much as I, you know, retain a love for vinyl, I'm not maniacal, you know, and I'm not exclusive, and I'm not against, you know, the digital world. And real particularly, you know, I will muddle around on YouTube and find things that I've never heard before. And actually, one of the things I like is the robots are very helpful. So seriously, if I find a given song, you know how they'll give you, the algorithm will spit up a whole column of similar songs and their opinion. And a lot of it is bullshit, but sometimes there's a gem. So
how much of this is new and by young artists that aren't just covering older songs, but just...
Well, you know, it depends on what you mean by new. I mean, you know, to me, I find, you know, records I haven't heard before, recordings I haven't heard before all the time. Some of them might have been recorded in the 30s. So that's new to me. But you're talking about things recorded, say, in the last 5 years?
Yeah, are people writing new Christmas classics?
Is it just like Ariana Grande decides that she needs to do a Christmas album and she's like, okay, I'm going to get I'll Be Home for Christmas. You know, I'll sort of get the five standards.
Well, yeah, but you know, that's, I mean... You'd hope that a creative artist is going to be truly creative, you know, when presented with an opportunity like this. But some of them, I'd say the majority of them, do the conventional thing. And, you know, maybe it's not just a function of creativity per se. You know, there are marketing concerns and respect for tradition and all the rest of it. But, you know, I'm open to it. You know, is there going to be a wonderful new version of Jingle Bells or White Christmas that I hear? If so, it makes it.
You would still listen. So if to follow Stephanie's example, Ariana Grande puts out a Christmas album, you would still be like, okay, I'll give it a listen.
I do.
Huh.
Yeah, I'll listen. And I reject things very quickly. Likewise, I accept things very quickly. You know, I mean, I've been a musical lover my whole life. And, you know, typically if I put, let's say it's a record, I'm going to describe this in antique terms, but if I put the needle down on a record and you know, I don't have a glimmer of hope inside of the first 15 seconds or so, right, I'm pulling the needle off.
You bail.
Done.
You give a novel 25 pages, no more.
So is there any track that you discovered that really kind of resonated? You know, something
this year?
No, just in the last...
Yeah, like what's a great discovery?
Yeah,
like
something that
I can't
really
believe I didn't know this one.
Floored you.
Well, here's what leapt to mind. There's a guy named Freddie King who kind of followed in the footsteps of, let's say, B.B. King. He was a great, great guitarist and songwriter and singer whose career began in the early 60s. And he was, I mean, for what it's worth, he was tremendously influential to all the British invasion kids. But he wrote a song called Christmas Tears, which is just absurdly magnificent to me, to my taste. You know, it's beautifully written, it's beautifully sung, it's beautifully produced. He plays the hell out of it. And, you know, is it the national anthem of Christmas? It's not. But for me, it never fails to move me.
What about that Sharon Jones Hanukkah song a few years ago?
Well, a few years ago, I put it on my Christmas, you know, I put it on the Christmas jollies. So I like it, but, you know, I will tell you this. And once again, it's that Jewish conspiracy in effect, because I believe that all her bandmates and producers happen to be Yids. And they wrote that song. And so, you know, for her to talk about, you know, my grandpa Saul and the rest of it, no. That's not her grandfather.
But did you like that? Was 8 Days of Christmas. I hadn't heard that before.
Yeah.
You had not heard
no.
that? No, I'm saying that's an original song written by, you know, a Jewish composer for his black associate.
So what is it with Jews and Christmas songs? Because when I started working at Tablet, Jewish magazine, the first Christmas rolls around and it's like, did you know all the Christmas songs were written by Jews? You know, there's White Christmas. There's also the chestnuts roasting on an open fire, that there's Santa Baby, the silver bells, and you're like, what?
You know why? I'll tell you why. Because there's, you know, is Christmas a religious holiday? It is for those who are religious, okay? Is it also a secular holiday in America? Likewise, you know? It is. And so, you know, Irving Berlin, you know, I thought, you know, the way he dealt with not just Christmas, but Easter is kind of clever. So he writes a Christmas song called White Christmas. And, you know, does Jesus make an appearance? He does not. Basically, it's a weather report.
Right.
It's snowing outside of Christmas time, okay? Likewise, Easter Parade. He wrote Easter Parade, okay? Is it about the resurrection of the Lord? It is not. It is about It's about a fashion show.
So now I think is a great point of conversation to note and reveal to our listeners that you were involved in, present for the writing of what I strongly believe is the greatest Christmas song ever written, Christmas in Hollis, by Run DMC. Tell us about that masterpiece, because I've heard a lot of stories about how that came to be.
Okay, so by 1987, I'd been making my Christmas jollies for several years. And I was the director of publicity at Rush Artist Management, and we managed Run DMC, among others.
Which is a job you kind of stumble upon, right? You came here to be a writer. You took this great, you know, test at Time Warner Billing or Time Life magazines, and then didn't work out, and you kind of found your way into hip-hop, more or less?
I'd been, you know, I've always been a music lover, and, you know, starting in 73 or so, I worked more or less continuously as a writer and a critic about music. And by 1979, when the first rap records came out, I was the pop music critic at the Boston Herald. And these records were fairly astonishing to me. Great records.
Hit it!
And one of them, really probably the second rap record I ever heard, certainly the second big national pop hit rap record, was by a guy named Curtis Blow, and the song was called Christmas Rapping, and it came out in time for Christmas of 1979, and it was such a phenomenon that they were still playing it in February. You know, so that's by 79, okay? A year later, I've moved to New York, and I'm still paying attention. And the same Curtis Blow, who happens to be a New Yorker, he's from Harlem, has a new record out. It's called The Breaks, and it was a national hit, a bigger hit than Christmas Rappin'. And so I went to my editor at the Daily News and I said, look, this is a local story. Let me write it. And he said, go ahead. So at that point, I started to hear about Kurt's manager, Russell Simmons.
Break it up, break it up, break it up.
1984, Ronald freaking Reagan is running for re-election. And I was not a fan. And I was paying enough attention to rap by that point to think to myself, geez, if we wrote an anti-Reagan rap, maybe we could rap Ronald Reagan out of a second term. That was my brilliant idea. So I wrote a rap and I took it to Russ, and Russell was very kind. I don't think he thought very much of my rhymes, but he says, well, what else are you up to? And I said, well, I've got ideas for movies, and I've been working with this guy who used to work with John Lennon, and yada, 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 yada. And Russell perked right up and he said, I want to make movies with my artists. Why don't you come work with me? And I said, fine. And he had no idea what I was supposed to do for him. I was his second full-time employee. And after hanging out for a week or two, I told him, I said, look, you don't have a publicist here. I've worked as a critic for 10 years. I know the publicist shtick. Let me do that for you. And Russell said, go ahead. So in 1987, I was the one who got the call about this Christmas opportunity. It was for what would be the first installation of this series called A Very Special Christmas that was sponsored by the Special Olympics. It, as I said, by then I'm paying attention to Christmas records. And so when I heard about this, I knew, as we discussed, that, you know, most of the artists were going to just cover, you know, a standard. And I called Run & D and I said, listen, you have this opportunity. Why not, you know, cut a new song? Here's a concept for you, Christmas and Hollis. And both of them said, okay. And Run sat down and wrote something, and D wrote something, and they went into the studio to record it. And I went with them. And at that point, it was up to me kind of to tie. I also had ideas. I had a crate full of Christmas records by then. I brought that crate into the studio, and Jay, Jam Master Jay, kind of fingered his way through it. And he pulled out it was various artists' album on Atlantic Records, you know, R&B Christmas. And he put the needle down once on a track. He wasn't feeling it. He put it down on another track. He wasn't feeling it. He put it down a third time. And he heard, you know, the intro to this one song, and he's kind of feeling it. He picked up the needle, put it back down, and played it again. And by the time he played it for the third time, you saw Run & D.
Already beginning to.
They were in another room smoking a joint. they came. It was as if they, you know, it was like, I don't know if you ever saw, you guys are so young, I don't know if you ever saw the Heckle and Jekyll cartoons, mm-hmm. but there are a couple of black crows, and you see them in the sky, and they're you know, shooting the shit, and all of a sudden, you know, this aroma wafts up into the sky from some pies on a windowsill, you know, and you see the crows bomb down to the windowsill. That was Run & D. While the boys are out to play. Look at him. I ain't like old Saint Nick. They heard this record, and it was enough. They came and they didn't say anything, but all three of them knew that would be the track, and it happened to be Clarence Carter singing a song called Backdoor Santa. And that was the...
And from there to MTV, to Die Hard, to Less Than Zero, I mean, that song's everywhere.
People like it still.
It's Christmas time in Hollis, Queens. Mom's cooking chicken and collard greens. Rice and stuffing macaroni and cheese. And Santa put gifts under Christmas trees. Decorate the house with...
Bill Adler, if people are to... If they're interested in hearing this year's mix, how does a random Jew of the public get to hear this year's mix?
Well, happily, I'm interviewed year after year by the podcast called The Cipher. And as part of the interview, they post the sequence. And
amazing.
By the time this interview runs, probably that interview will run, and anybody who has a computer can hear the thing.
And like 2018 is a strong year.
Yeah.
It's like we know a guy at The Cipher.
It's like it's like our producer, Josh Cross, also works at The Cipher. Bill Adler, thank you so much for being our Jew of the Week.
And Bill, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And a very happy Hanukkah.
Josh, if people want to hear the playlist from Bill Adler, where should they go?
I'm going to post links to the last 5 years or so in the Facebook group, as well as some other interviews that we've done with him, because he's just an awesome dude.
And if people aren't on the Facebook group and really need them, you can just email Josh Cross at jcross@tabletmag.com.
With a K.
With a K. Two live shows coming up. January 15th, a free show at Washington Hebrew Congregation. We have the guest of the century, Representative-elect Katie Porter, an old, old friend of mine, once a mild-mannered law professor, now heading to Congress from California's 45th District. She is, I think, going to be the only single mother of young children in Congress, maybe ever. I could be getting that wrong, but she has like three fairly young kids. She is divorced and she's heading to Congress with amazing progressive values. She knocked off an incumbent who deserved to be knocked off by my lights anyway. But the point is, and this is going to be like a week, 10 days after she's inaugurated. She's inaugurated January 3rd. And then I think her first interfaith event. Certainly her first event with the Jews is going to be at Washington Hebrew Congregation.
You've got to start them early.
Got to start them early. This is a show being co-sponsored by the Association of Reformed Jewish Educators. It's a free show at Washington Hebrew Congregation. This 7:30 p.m. January 15th. Go to whctemple.org for more info. And we're trying to book maybe a non-Gentile congresswoman elect as well. I'm hoping for a congressional blowout that night, but we'll see. And then Saturday, February 2nd, we'll be at the Stroom JCC in Seattle with Dan Savage doing a co-show with the Savage Lovecast. We want to bring your questions. We're already getting some rolling in. We need your sexy time questions. We need your questions appropriate for Dan Savage, the world's leading sex, love, romance columnist. You can send them to unorthodox@tabletmag.com. You could also call them in, and then you could like disguise your voice a little bit if you're worried about anonymity. Josh can also put a weird filter over your voice when we play them so that nobody knows it's you. But don't be shy. We have several questions already. We want several more to choose from. 914-570-4869. They can be sex related or just sex related or just love. He does a lot of just relationship advice. How do you call someone? How do you ask someone out? Should I stay in this relationship? Should I not? Go listen to Savage Lovecast to prep for that show and get your tickets. February 2nd, Stroom JCC in Seattle. And Liel was also here for the Stephen D'Souza interview. Have a listen.
Our Gentile of the Week is a very special guest. He is Stephen D'Souza, a producer, a director, and a screenwriter of basically every film that ever made me want to go to the movies and love them, including Commando, including Judge Dredd, including 48 Hours, and most famously and reverentially, Die Hard. And sir, here I say this without a trace of irony. If we had to preserve just one document to show the world what America's spirit was about, to my mind, it's not the Constitution or Declaration of Independence or the Gettysburg Address. It is Die Hard. It is the most perfect American film ever made. Hello. Welcome to the show.
Oh boy. Okay. I was looking so forward to this interview. I was so thrilled. And now I see there's been a little of a communications a breakdown, or as I always quote my movie quotes, and what we have here is a failure to communicate, if I can date myself by doing a Paul Newman movie.
Some men you just can't reach.
No, I don't qualify for this interview. I am not your Gentile. Somehow you guys got the impression that long ago buried in my past were refugees of the Spanish Inquisition. No, I'm Jewish. My parents are Jewish. My grandparents going back to like not the year Gimel, but
wait, you know, D'Souza, listen, man, this has happened to us before. First of all, it doesn't make a damn bit of difference to us. We have Jews and Gentiles on this
show.
Well,
no, but now you have to go out and get it. Now you have to go out and get a real Gentile guest.
No. This is no. We live in the moment, and we try to have a Jew and a Gentile on every show. It has happened that sometimes this has happened before, where people whose last names are kind of sneaky end up being Jewish, and we just roll with it. We are fallible, okay, and our audience knows us warts and all. And sometimes, I mean, we should know by now that Hollywood screenwriter, genius, probably a Jew. And yet here we are. We figure there could be a Gentile
and
there,
so,
right?
I won't repeat the whole introduction, but I will just say our Jewish guest of the week is Stephen D'Souza.
But we're obviously going to play that whole thing.
Oh, I mean, absolutely, we are. Welcome again to the show, Brother D'Souza.
D'Souza.
Who also happened to write, not only is this the greatest American movie, but it also is, probably without any doubt, the greatest Christmas movie. It's
Christmas. This is John.
Nice beer.
He just wants to spend Christmas with the family.
Is Daddy coming home with you?
We'll see what Santa and Mommy can do.
But when he gets stuck at the office party...
Merry Christmas!
It'll be a holiday...
Merry Christmas!
...he'll never forget.
Ho, ho, ho. I'm starting to get a bad feeling up here. Merry Christmas.
Die Hard.
This is their idea of Christmas. I gotta be here for New Year's.
Which I think is an opinion that a lot of people argue about, but do you agree with, right?
Yes, I agree with it, and it's we can take a deep dive into it. This debate's been going on for a while. I usually have my my bubble of fame. I mean, my idea of fame. I just want to be famous enough. I've achieved my level of fame, which is where the key major D's recognize me. That's all I need. You know, every time I think I'm sort of like famous, if I go to Comic-Con, which I do sometimes, and someone with all their like loot bags is walking towards me, and I see their eyes open, and they go, and they recognition. This is never some gorgeous young lady in a cosplay costume. It's like the guy who stole Woody in Toy Story.
Yeah,
or it's comic book guy.
It's a guy who looks in other words.
I have to imagine that with radio. You put a picture in my head.
A fat bearded Jew.
I want to say, what are you wearing? But don't tell me.
So, I mean, this is something that's been that, as you say, this debate's been going on a while. And I've even seen it reported that Joel Silver showed up on the set and said this is going to be played every year at Christmas on cable.
He absolutely did say that. He was right about that.
I mean, why? I mean, why not Less Than Zero, which also begins at Christmas? But I don't think anyone watches that at Christmas time. You know, why this one?
Well, I think it started out with the idea that this is the antidote to the usual cloying, saccharine, you know, let's all learn a lesson opening shot of most Christmas movies, where this one that sneaks up on you. And of course, it's the kids could say, it is a Christmas movie, Mom.
And it is very much about the triumph of the human spirit and family and joy and peace on earth over Hans Gruber.
I also want to say that one of the great things about this movie is that, so my friend Seth and I have a sort of a running list of the great movie dicks, like who plays a good villain. And Rickman, of course, is near the top of that. But Paul Gleason and William Atherton also play great movie dicks throughout 80s movies. And somehow this movie actually has, it's the only movie with Rickman, Gleason, who plays the idiot cop, right, and Atherton, who plays the news reporter, are all in this movie. Like, the asshole quotient of the villains in this movie is simply through the roof. And I don't know if that's a testament to Silver or to the casting director who had the vision to make the bad guys so bad, but it's beautifully executed.
That's Jackie Birch, who I've worked with on several pictures. She was the casting director on this picture, and she gets kudos for that. You know, like, in other words, a lot of people would say, let's get one of these assholes. But she would have she'd be bold enough to say, let's get two of them. She also was responsible, I think, for the unique look of the Hans Gruber's crew, because when Alan Rickman came in, first of all, she alerted producers and directors, all of us, to Alan Rickman's existence. He had never done a motion picture, and she saw him in New York. On Broadway in I'll garble this, Les Liaisons Dangereux. I don't know how my, you know, seventh grade French teacher, I hope she's not listening. Anyway, but when Rickman came in for a costume fitting, and they brought out all this military mufti, commando gear, you know, with the web belt and tactical jackets and stuff like that, he says, I look ridiculous wearing this. And that inspired her. Of course, he had a lead role. And then she said, they all came from Europe. Let's make them look like fashion models. That was actually her quote. And she came in and argued for that.
Yeah, I mean, she found one guy who looked just like Fabio. I mean, it's really amazing how...
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
So if someone comes up to you and says, like, I've never seen Die Hard, what's it about? What do you say?
How long have you been in this country?
I want, in case any of our listeners haven't seen it.
Well, Die Hard is sort of like White Christmas with guns.
So, talking about guns, look, I am very earnest here. Literally, my entire childhood has been I grew up in Israel, going to one really kind of rinky cinema in Tel Aviv and watching week after week with my dad everything you ever wrote. And these films shaped my entire worldview. And to my great chagrin, they don't make films like Commando anymore. You know, there seems to be like a real sea change in the way Hollywood makes movies. Why is that? What happened to us?
Well, I think what happened to Commando and also to Rambo and pictures like that was Die Hard. I mean, by the time we got to Die Hard, the heroes of the movies had become these roid-raged specimens that were, one-man armies. I mean, if you take a kind of a seminal scene from Rambo, the evil commies grab Sylvester Stallone. They, they beat him with, like, clubs. They strap him to rings of a mattress. I don't know how the mattress got in the middle of the jungle, but anyway. And then they put car batteries on him. He breaks loose. He kills everybody in the room. Then he grabs the microphone and calls bad guy headquarters and says, "They're all dead, and I'm coming for you next." When we sent the script out of Die Hard for casting, in the wake of that and the wake of Commando, these kind of roles, in comparison, this character seemed like weak because he was a normal person. So, right. The litany of people who turn down this part, here's a good bar bet. You're in a bar and you say to somebody, you know that character who's the hero of Die Hard 2 and Die Hard 3 and Die Hard with a Vengeance? Who was the first person to play that part and in what picture? And they'll, of course, say Bruce Willis in Die Hard. And you grab their money and run out real fast before they break your thumbs when you say, no, Frank Sinatra. Because Die Hard is based on a novel, Nothing Lasts Forever, which is a sequel to an earlier novel by the same author, Roderick Thorpe, called The Detective, which was made as a movie in the 60s with Frank Sinatra. And Frank Sinatra is the Bruce Willis part. And in fact, we had to offer this part to Sinatra first. He was contractually bound to any sequel. Fortunately, he said, "I'm too old and too rich for this. Otherwise, the chases in the building would have been on Rascal Scooters."
And the line would have been, "Yippee-ki-yay, mother lover.
Ring-a-ding, kid."
Ring-a-ding, kid. You've made all these celebrated films, but you made two films that I have felt for decades were horribly mistreated and really two of the most underrated movies ever written and made, one of which I believe you even directed as well, Street Fighter and Hudson Hawk. Do you have love for both of these movies?
Well, you say, I love all my children, even the one that, keeps sneaking out at night to go to bars. I would say probably Street Fighter a little more, because even though a lot of things went wrong, the things that went right were in my control. The other picture was a wild ride, let's put it that way. At one point, I thought I was done with the film, and then the studio called me up and said, "You got to go to Italy, and get the script on track." And I'm thinking, that's not my job. But if you know the old Aesop's fable about who will bell the cat, when you have a film that is big expensive production. With a lot of producers, and one of the problems in Hollywood has become that everything's so expensive now that it takes several entities to make anything. So the day when somebody said, "I like this story, we're shooting it," and it's a one-person decision, rarely happens now.
So Stephen, before we let you go and get back to sleep, because I know it's very early over there in Hollywood, besides Die Hard, what is your favorite Christmas movie?
What is my favorite Christmas movie? So I thought, well, I guess White Christmas, because I last year when this debate was going on for the first time, and when Jay Tapper got into it and contacted me on Twitter, probably my greatest moment of notoriety on his coattails, I made a chart up to comparing Die Hard to White Christmas to prove that Die Hard is even more Christmassy than White Christmas. So if I could do the chart. Okay, so here's the chart. This is a Christmas movie or not checklist. Takes place during Christmas holiday. Die Hard.
Check.
Entirely. White Christmas, only the first and closing scenes. Is the setting a Christmas party? Die Hard entirely. White Christmas, only the final scene. The number of Christmas songs? 3. Die Hard has Let It Snow, Winter Wonderland, and Christmas in Hollis. White Christmas has two. White Christmas and Snow. And Snow is even arguably not a Christmas song. Snow, 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 right? Any more than Jingle Bells. The party venue is threatened in Die Hard by terrorists. In White Christmas, by foreclosure on the venue. Who's the broadcaster with a hidden agenda? In Die Hard, it's Dick Thornburg. In White Christmas, it's Johnny Grant, the stand-in for Ed Sullivan, who's part of the deceit on the general. The German ringleader is Hans Gruber. In White Christmas, it's Hitler.
And then, of course, there's the all-important category. Does the Christmas phrase, Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker, get uttered, which I believe it does not in White Christmas?
Die Hard,
Jack. No. Well, in the uncut version, you could find the outtakes on the internet if you look carefully enough. Then we have the government incompetence. The government incompetence in Die Hard is the FBI overreacts. In White Christmas, it's the Pentagon fires General Waverly. And finally, and this is the Christ-like sacrifice... In Die Hard, is running barefoot over broken glass to save everyone. In White Christmas, it's Danny Kaye nobly giving his upgrading Vera Ellen's train tickets.
This has been, I feel like, a 3-minute film school. By the way, what is the origin of that famous catchphrase?
The origin of that famous catchphrase is when I first met Bruce and we started talking, I realized we grew up about 30 miles apart. He's 6 years younger than me, the same point spread as my younger brother. And we started talking about all the our childhood, how we used to play, how making these kind of movies is like playing Army under the boardwalk in Atlantic City. We talked about the TV shows we used to watch, and one of them was the Roy Rogers TV show. I forget, Roy Rogers used to say happy trails at the end of the show, which is what he says to Hans as Hans goes out the window. And Roy Rogers also would say, had a song, he sang one of his pictures, Yippee-ki-yay, which is the Western term. So that's how it got in the picture. Now, I wrote Yippee-ki-yay, asshole. And Bruce, as an ad-lib, did one version with motherfucker. We can say motherfucker on radio. This
yes,
isn't
we can.
Even radio. This is a podcast.
Correct. So that was the origin of Yippee. So Bruce ad-libbed in the motherfucker for the asshole, and you know, a catchphrase was born.
Exactly. And of course, there's a whole game people play, like, with the replacement for On the Air. You know, like Melon Farmer. You know that one, Yippee-ki-yay, Melon Farmer is one of the replacements for a TV broadcast.
Oh, when they showed on network TV, Yippee-ki-yay, Melon Farmer. Steven, we are so grateful that you got up so early on the West Coast to be our... we thought you were a Gentile of the Week. It turns out even better... Covert Jew of the Week.
It's a Christmas miracle.
Thank you for being on Unorthodox, yeah. Steven D'Souza.
I can't believe there wasn't, you know, any Jewish conversation at all. I was like, you know, trying to find my old 33 and a third Haftorah record.
Can you do your Haftorah?
Do your Haftorah for us.
So I could, I couldn't, don't make me do that. I stumbled through the baruch for the Hanukkah candles my daughter had to pitch in. I'm supposed to get to ask one question, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
Isn't that a thing?
You're
going to
ask the Gentile question of the week as a Jew? Do it, man.
Is that what it's, I'm already posting the streams here. Oh, now that there's something we didn't get into is I did not hear much Yiddish as a child. I mainly got it from nightclub comedians because my dad's family, they'd been speaking English for like, you know, 400 years in the British West Indies. And my father had six brothers and like multiple cousins. So I was surrounded by all these Jew-makins, as they called themselves, with their, you know, wacky foods and wacky accents. And my mother had a single brother in Philadelphia who only had two kids. So I'd be in Hollywood and like Glenn Larson, who was a Mormon, you know, he'd say in the meeting, we got Gornish. And I go, what's that? And he says, wait a minute, didn't you take Yom Kippur off? How do you not know what that means? You know, so I picked up more Yiddish working for Gentiles in Hollywood than I ever did at home. But anyway, here's my question.
Okay.
So isn't jerk chicken the traditional Passover meal?
Absolutely.
You know?
We'll have to have you back in Passover to talk about that.
It was at our gathering. So I'm going to go to the exotic Jewish food. There is a Jewish recipe, a regional Jewish recipe, called ghid. So my question for your audience is, what is ghid?
Do you know, Liel?
I have no idea.
So here's what we're going to do for you. Usually there's a question we can answer. But in this case, we actually, you've stumped the internationally recognized panel of Jewish experts. So this interview is going to air on our Christmas show in 2 weeks. And then we're going to come back sometime in the new year, in the week, in our first or second show, and we're going to answer for you what is Gid and thousands of curious Jews and Gentiles in listener land are going to learn. Thanks to you.
Sir, this has been an honor, a pleasure, and we'll have to have you back to talk Jamaican and
Jamaican. Jamaican cuisine.
And everything else. And in the meanwhile, we'll be watching Die Hard again and again.
Thank you, sir.
Again and again. We can also talk as Die Hard to a Christmas movie. It also takes place at Christmas.
That's next year's conversation.
That's next year's interview.
Thank you, sir.
That was Stephen D'Souza, our Jewish guest.
Jewish guest of the week.
Very Jewish.
Very Jewish.
Hard to get a Gentile around these parts.
Even when we try.
Even when we try.
Tell me in the day or the night, would it kill you to call or write?
Back to the mailbox this week. We've been away from the mailbox for a while. It gets
out of office.
Yeah, its feelings get hurt when we're away from it. So we've returned with a vengeance. Two great letters about our superstition episode. Here's the first. Dear Unorthodox, I am 15 and I live in Ra'anana, Israel. I go to school at Pelech Tel Aviv, which is in Tel Aviv, about an hour bus ride away, so I have a lot of time for listening to podcasts. I used to listen only to science podcasts until my mom introduced me to Unorthodox. She's been a fan since the beginning. And now it's my favorite podcast, too. Every Thursday, I get on the bus at around 6:48 in the morning, as usual, and then I wait clutching my phone until 7 a.m. Israel time, when Unorthodox is usually uploaded. The second it comes up, I start listening, trying to get through as much as I can in the morning, and finishing it on the ride home from school. I'm always curious if I'm the first listener of the day. Usually, on mornings before tests, my friend and I study, but on Thursdays, she knows that Unorthodox tops studying. I love that we're destroying academic careers in several time zones. I really enjoyed last week's episode on superstitions, but one group of superstitions I wish you had mentioned were the ones made up to keep people, especially women, from doing certain things. For example, if a woman drinks wine from the Havdalah, she will grow a beard. We didn't even know that one. I also love how funny and casual your podcast is, and you have such interesting guests like Rabbi Sachs. Come visit Ra'anana, Yaira Granoff.
I love that.
We do want to come visit you.
Can I just say shout out to all the mums? Because that story of moms making their kids who are skeptical and like, Mom, no, I don't want to listen. And then they listen, like, oh my God. And that's even, you know,
I love that moms and daughters are listening. That makes me so happy.
And sons and stuff.
No, but I'm just saying, like, different generations.
Bringing the generations closer together since 2015.
Listen to your mother.
Yeah, listen to your mother.
The other thing I have to say, though, my mother-in-law did point out a superstition that her family has that I've been, you know, inculcated with now that I've joined the Cohen clan, is you're not allowed to nap on Rosh Hashanah because you'll sleep away the new year. You can nap on Yom Kippur, but not Rosh Hashanah.
Interesting.
Which is a problem for me because I always go to their house and just fall asleep immediately on a couch.
Because other people's houses are so comfortable.
I love it.
What is it about other people's houses that are so comfortable?
Maybe they just made it up for you.
No, it's real. That shit is real.
Like, actually, the code tradition is when someone marries into the family, they make up a ridiculous superstition and be like, what? What kind of
Jew? And I'm always like so sleepy on Rosh Hashanah.
All right. Here's another great one. This is from Batya Minkin. Hi, Mark, Stephanie, and Liel. You guys are fantastic. The superstition episode reminded me of a practice that I'm not sure falls under the category of superstition, but I thought you might want to hear about it nonetheless. I'm not very superstitious, but there is something called the prayer for lost objects, and I swear to God it's some kind of black magic. If you can't find something, you wash your hands, give a coin to tzedakah, and say a prayer. Then you go look for your lost object. And she gives us a link to the prayer at the Chabad website. Guys, I know this sounds crazy, but this has never failed me. I've used it tens of times over the course of my life, but two episodes stick with me. When I was a teen, I couldn't find a CD I loved. I said the prayer, and then the next morning, my brother came into my room looking confused and holding the CD I was looking for. And he said, "Do you have any idea why this was in my closet?" And recently, I was getting my 3-year-old ready for school, and I couldn't find his left shoe anywhere. I live in an 81 square meter apartment, so there are only so many places it could have been, and it was literally nowhere. Finally, I decided to say the prayer, and not 10 minutes later, I found the shoe next to the leg of the dining room table, a place I had obviously already checked multiple times. All the best, Batya. All right, so the prayer for lost objects, there you have it. Batya says it's real. I'm skeptical, but you know what? I lose things all the time, and so I will have a chance to check this out soon. And now, a call for advice. Greetings, Leslie writes. I'm one of the odd lurking Gentiles who adores your show. I have a holidays-related question. I hope you could help me. I grew up in the suburbs of Detroit, and while I've long since moved abroad, one way I keep in contact with family and friends is by sending annual Christmas cards. My husband and I make them by hand and add a picture and a short update of our lives over the past 12 months. Every year, though, I'm struck about what to do with my Jewish friends. As someone who takes the Christ rather than the simple Xmas of the season seriously, my cards usually sport a nativity scene. And sending a card emblazoned with, "Hark, the Savior is born," just doesn't seem kosher. I could, of course, go for something neutral like Happy Holidays or Season's Greetings, but that feels like a lame cop-out. So my question is twofold. First, do Jewish people send Hanukkah cards to each other? And second, would it be appropriate for me to do so as a goy? Sincerely, Leslie. The first thing I want to say is that making your own very Christian Christmas card by hand and adding a picture is the most goyish thing I've ever heard.
Yep.
And I mean that as a compliment. That's like, that's what I want my Christians to do, is to sit crafting their Christmas cards.
I like that a lot.
Yeah. Now, you have two questions you've given to us. First, do Jewish people send Hanukkah cards to each other? Josh Cross and Stephanie Butnick, what is, like, we have not talked about this beforehand, right? What is your experience of that question? Do we send Hanukkah cards?
I have never sent Hanukkah cards. We have sent New Year's cards a couple of times, but
at
we don't...
Rosh Hashanah or Gentile New Year's?
Gentile New Year's.
Okay, interesting.
Roman calendar,
Gregorian New Year's. Okay.
But it's not a thing that I grew up with. I know other people do. It's just, it's a very American goyish kind of thing. It doesn't bother me.
No.
But
Stephanie?
I think Jewish families definitely send like a Happy Holidays card. I think that I think what Leslie does is more rare, right? A very explicitly Christian message. A lot of the times you get like Happy Holidays, Season's Greetings.
From Jews.
From anyone, right? Like you don't get very Christian,
But her question is like Jews to Jews, are we Happy Hanukkah
card? I think it is in response to Christmas. It's the way that Hanukkah has sort of mushroomed in response to Christmas. I will say that I am on the Christmas card list for a few of my friends' families who aren't Jewish, and I love it so much.
Yeah.
I get the O'Neill Christmas card every year. It makes me immeasurably happy.
Oh.
And it doesn't say, I don't even know what it says. It probably says like Happy Holidays, but I wouldn't care if it said Merry Christmas.
So I just want to say, first of all, I think I'm getting agreement here that Hanukkah cards are not really a thing. That Jews who buy into the season will often send a happy holiday thing or the family letter. And don't get me started. I love I want more of the letters that have like, you know, my wife got certified as
a
physical
therapist. You do those videos, right?
Cancer's in remission again.
Yeah, cancer's in remission and so-and-so made JV field hockey. And my wife does a video, a holiday video that goes to select people. But a lot of Jews do Rosh Hashanah cards. That is a thing, is Happy Holidays at Rosh Hashanah. So if you're a little more sort of Jewy, the Rosh Hashanah card is the annual card that you would do. I will say for myself, and I think this gets to the question you're really asking, is like, can you send Christmas cards to Jews? I'm with Stephanie. Like, I love, like, the more Christian, the better. I think not all Jews feel that way.
I don't know. I mean, like, Hark, the Savior is Born is intense.
It's a little preachy.
But I'm like, if that's your card and I know you and I know you've put this together by hand and these are your values, I would never be like,
totally.
Ick.
Ick.
If
you're really hearkening to a real savior in your mind, bring it.
I think it depends on who the person is and how well you know them. I feel like you probably know. It seems like if you're asking, it's probably people who wouldn't want it.
Right.
I felt like the other question that was buried in there was whether or not she could get or whether or not they could get different ones to send to. And that's totally respectful and cool also.
If you got a Hanukkah card from a practicing Christian friend of yours, because that's one option.
That would actually be very sweet.
It's super like they're trying even if they don't. Like that's like an extra step.
But it seems like that's Leslie going to a lot of work after hand making a Christmas card.
Leslie, I'm actually going to throw this out there. I think you should ask them. I think you should pick a few people. It sounds like you have maybe 5 to 10 Jewish friends on your list. Pick the 3 or 4 or 5 whom you know the best, who are the most kind of like chill about this stuff, and just say, look, I got a question. Like, you know, I'm pretty Jesus-y. I know you're pretty Jewy. What card would you like to get from me?
No, just like, do you feel comfortable? I have a Christmas card. I don't want to make you uncomfortable. Would you like to receive it?
Yeah. And if not, what if you got a Hanukkah card from me? And
but I will
report
say,
back to us.
Leslie, please send us one of these Christmas cards. We would really like to receive it. Send it to Unorthodox Podcast at P.O. Box 20079, New York, New York 10001. That's our mailbox.
And now
I
that it's
that
out
so
there,
bad.
Send us mail.
Send us now that it's out there. I want your holiday letters. I want to know about like Uncle Shloimey's gout. I want to know about your daughter Mackenzie's, you know, getting cast in the school play. Put us on the list.
It's the Sound of Music, and there are no Nazis.
Mazel tovs. Josh Cross sitting in the Liel chair today. Do you have a mazel tov to offer?
Mazel tov to Judy Gold and her son, who graduated from Indiana University.
Judy Gold, unorthodox guest extraordinaire,
and Upper West Side friend who I run into randomly. She's awesome.
You see Judy around?
I ran into Judy in a sub shop once. And she's like, oh my God, isn't Jim Martin amazing? And we were quelling over Jim. It was wonderful.
That's amazing. Stephanie?
I have some shout outs. My new friend, Caroline Radnowski, she's a listener of the podcast. And she was in town for training. And the person she was sitting next to at work is Ali Gustanian, who was wearing an unorthodox sweatshirt because their office is very cold. So she's a fan too, and it was very fun to meet. I didn't meet Ali, but I met Caroline, and she's the best.
I have a couple. One is to unorthodox listener and correspondent Nate Leibovitz. He sent a letter this week that was so touching about what we meant to him and his listening life, but also his life. And we get a lot of letters and we read them all, and many of them are moving. And I just, for some reason, Nate is on my mind this morning. Also to unorthodox superstar guest Tova Feldshuh, the actor. She had her first grandson, Raphael. So mazel tov to Tova and her husband, Andy, and the whole mishpucha. That is amazing. And finally, my daughter, Ellie, had a couple gymnastics meets recently. And I just want to say that she came in 14th in the all around at level 4 at the meet in Bridgeport, Connecticut last week, I think it was. And, you know, I don't know anyone who works harder at anything than she does at gymnastics. It's like 10 hours a week in the gym, a lot of conditioning that would like literally give me a hernia. And it's an amazing thing to watch a 10-year-old do. So mazel tov, Ellie. Unorthodox brought to you by Tablet Magazine, on the web at tabletmag.com. You can get our newsletter by writing to unorthodox@tabletmag.com and putting newsletter in the subject line. We often come to you live to book us or advertise with us. Email producer Josh Cross, that's Cross with a K, at jcross@tabletmag.com. If you want to wear or carry Unorthodox or put an Unorthodox onesie around your newborn little child, you can go to bit.ly/unorthoshirt and spend some of that hard-won money. Follow us on Instagram at Unorthodox Podcast and on Twitter at Unorthodox_pod. Join our Facebook group on Facebook. Our show was produced by Josh Cross, Shira Talushkin, and Noah Levinson. Our editor is Sophia Steinert-Evoy. Our artwork is by Esther Werdiger. Our social media intern is Elazar Abrams. Our new holiday time intern is Jillian Forstadt.
Yay, Jillian.
Yay, Jillian. Yay. Our theme music is by Golem, online at golemrocks.com. Our mailbox theme is by Steve Barton. Rabbinic supervision this week by Rabbi Jonathan Perlman of New Light Congregation in Pittsburgh. And we come to you from Argo Studios, which says Merry Christmas, not Happy Holidays. Shalom, friends.